Well, the theme of a conversation earlier was that people are tired tonight. So my agreement was I'll try and preach quietly. So if you need to catch up on sleep, you can try and do that. As some of you guys know, I missed last week. I was gone with my 10-year-old daughter, and we went to Disneyland for her 10th birthday, and it was this special time. And at one point, I think we were talking. Oh, we were talking about crushes and about, you know, little fifth grade romance, which was just, I can't tell you about it, of course. But it's top secret. But she was talking about, you know, me meeting Rachel, my wife, and she said at one point, she said, "Daddy, I'm really glad you met Mommy, or I wouldn't be me." I thought, wow, that's true. Like, how funny that this person exists because two people have met. And I think that's a good example of the type of decision that we're looking at tonight. So 10 years and 9 months ago, my wife and I slept together. And we created a child. This little decision and a person results. Like, that's mind-blowing, right? So this is the theme we're thinking about tonight. Little choices, little decisions with huge consequences. And I think actually in a number of ways, sexuality is a good example, because a lot of big life-changing things can happen out of a very little decision when someone chooses to have sex, which kind of launches into a whole other interesting theology of what is happening in that moment. But it's not the only decision. There's all sorts of times where we do something and a very small choice could completely change everything about your life, could completely change your direction. You know, accidents happen because of little choices, and you think later, if only I hadn't done this thing, then I would have avoided this. Or illnesses come, or diseases happen. So the decision we're looking at tonight is a decision that Moses made. And it's one that is really curious because it's a decision that had, for him, really severe consequences. And yet, it's actually hard to understand what it is that happened. Why this decision that he made resulted in the consequences it did. And we're going to wrestle with that a little bit and try and figure out what God is doing there. Sometimes it is little decisions that have these big impacts, and sometimes we feel like we're making huge decisions and we realize that the big decisions maybe don't change things as much. You know, you take a new job and you realize that's such a big deal, but life's kind of the same, and maybe it didn't change things all that much. Or you move to a new city and you think it's a big deal, but maybe it's not that big a deal. But then these little things can really blow up. So that's kind of what we're thinking about. We want to see where God is in that, how God interacts with us, what it's like to walk with God through those types of things. So just to catch us up, one more thing. So we're doing this series, Epic Decisions, and we've been following along with the epic series that we're doing as a whole church. And our approach has been to take little scenes from the larger chapters that we're looking at and focus on a single decision. So this week we're actually jumping ahead a little bit. And this week we're looking at a scene that we're going to be talking about this coming Sunday. We've been doing like the following one, but since we're missing the app next week, it's okay to get off a little. Trust me, I've got it under control. So jumping into Numbers 20. And what's happening here is that we catch up to people. This is after the Exodus. God's people have left Egypt. They've gone to Mount Sinai, they've received the law, they've tried to go to the promised land, and they failed. So now they've been wandering around the desert for 40 years. And this is towards the end of that period of God's people, about 2 million of them, wandering around in the desert, in the wilderness. And this happens. We don't know exactly when it is, but it's towards the end of that period. So I'm going to start off by reading Numbers 20, 1 to 5. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh. There Miriam died and was buried. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." So we have some complaining going on. And I want to kind of figure out what exactly is going on. So a lot of series of difficult things has happened, right? First of all, they've been wandering in the desert for 30 plus years, right? So they have a right to be a little grumpy, I think. We can forgive them a little bit. Second of all, it says that Miriam just died. Does anybody remember who Miriam is? Moses' sister. What did Miriam do when Moses was a little bitty baby?
Made a basket.
Yeah. Miriam made a basket. So Miriam saved Moses' life. She was there when Moses was put on the river. And then when Pharaoh's daughter found her, she went up to her and said, "Hey, do you want me to find a Hebrew woman to nurse this baby?" And she said, "Sure." So she brought her back to their mom. And Moses survived. So Miriam and Moses were obviously close. So Miriam passed away. Not given much fanfare here, but it's said there in verse 1. And then, on top of that, the people get grumpy. And the inciting factor, the thing that they're really upset about, is that they're thirsty. They're traveling around the desert, they get to this new place, and you can't camp with 2 million people in a place where there's no water, right? You're not going to last very long. So they get there, there's no water. They rise up, they start yelling at Moses, "What are you going to do? Why'd you bring us here? Blah, 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 blah. We were better off in Egypt. Where's the figs and grain? Yada, yada, yada." So, what we have here is we have an event. There's no water, right? That's the problem. But on the other hand, you have their response to the event. And their response to the event is dramatic, right? It's not just, "Gee, Moses, there's no water. Let's solve this problem." They kind of go nuclear, right? "Why'd you bring us here? We wish we were dead. This is awful," etc. It even says that they gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. So they challenged their leadership. They idealize the past, right? They say, "Boy, things were so much better in Egypt," when in fact, they weren't all that great in Egypt. They were slaves. They dramatize the future. You know, "We're all going to die here. This is going to be terrible." This is kind of like, sounds like a family road trip to me. But this is what happens when bad things happen, right? We look back and we think it was so much better. We look forward and think it's going to be terrible. We get grumpy. We rise up against each other. The interesting thing about this scene is that this isn't the first time this has happened. So you can imagine, they're traveling in the desert. They probably came to lots of places where there were no water. So they've seen this before. I'm going to go back and read from Exodus 17, which is a really similar scene. This is right after they leave Egypt. They haven't yet gotten to Mount Sinai. They haven't yet gotten the law. They're on their way, and this is what happens. "The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' Moses replied, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?' But the people were thirsty with water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, 'Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?' Then Moses cried out to the Lord, 'What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me.' The Lord answered Moses, 'Walk on ahead of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink.' So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel." So God's people had been here before. They'd been in a place where there was no water. They'd seen God provide, and now they get to a really similar circumstance, and they end up responding in a really similar way. "We wish we were in Egypt. We wish we were dead." So I want to think about this moment that's happening and think about some of the themes that are going on. So first of all, this is a repeated situation. And what I want us to do is I want us to think about ourselves in Moses' place, because Moses is the one making the decision that we're looking at tonight. And I want us to think about the factors that are pressing in on him as he's about to make a decision. So first of all, this is a repeated situation. He'd seen this before. He dealt with it before. And I think for us that when we see situations over and over and over again, it gets harder and harder to deal with them. The first time, maybe you do well. Second time, eventually you just get tired. And you snap. So that's the first thing. This is repeated. The second thing, there is the situation happening. They're at a place with no water. But there's all sorts of other unrelated things going on as well. Right? His sister has just died, for example. And so this is true of us too. When we're facing a particular decision, life is never segmented. You never get to work and face a decision and whatever happened to you that morning doesn't factor in. Or the person you're dating and what they said to you the night before, or your spouse, or the person you wish you were dating and aren't, or something. Everything that happens carries forward in us, right? And all of these things affect us. And so a situation is never just about the situation that's before you. And that was true for Moses here. His sister had just died. They've been wandering for a long time. Lots of sand in his shoes. All sorts of stuff like that. Third thing is that this had gotten personal, right? Moses is dealing with a very practical problem. No water. But the people hadn't just seen it as a practical problem, they'd attacked him. They quarreled with him, they challenged his leadership, they blamed him for everything. And again, this is what often happens. This happens in all sorts of relationships, it happens at work, it happens professionally, it happens in families, where there'll be a problem, and instead of simply dealing with the problem, things get personal, right? You always do this, or you always forget that, or you never pay attention, or whatever it is. It turns personal. It turns into a personal attack. So if we're going to identify with Moses, then these are some of the things that are going on. It's a repeated situation. He's seen it before. It's a situation that isn't isolated. There's other factors that are going on. And it's a situation that has a practical problem, but has turned really personal. And I want us to realize this, because most of the decisions we make have similar things facing us. Marriage, jobs, being a student, all of the little choices you make in all of those relationships and projects and tasks that we do, often they're repeated. Often you have to do the same things over and over again. Often you walk into a situation and there's something else that's happened that is affecting you, and you can't cleanse yourself. You can't isolate yourself. And often things get personal, maybe not from the situation, but maybe you're feeling stressed or feeling bad about yourself for some other reason. And so these are the types of things that happen in our lives. These are the types of situations we face. So we want to see then what Moses does with this. This is Numbers 20, verses 6 to 11. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community, so they and their livestock can drink." So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he had commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. So this is what Moses does. He's got a problem. People are grumbling. First thing he does, he and Aaron go on their face, pray to God. Right? So far, so good. Pretty good decision. God gives them some instructions. He says, take this staff and go and speak to this rock and it will give forth water. So far, so good, right? They've prayed, God's answered. And then Moses and Aaron go back to the assembly and they do some stuff. And this is where it gets a little bit confusing. So, hearing this, as it played out, did anybody notice anything wrong with what happened? What did you guys notice?
They didn't speak.
They didn't speak, okay. God told them to speak to the rock, and they didn't. What else?
They didn't attribute that to God.
They didn't attribute to God. How so?
He says something about rebels and then strikes the rock, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Must we bring you water out of the rock?
Mm-hmm. Instead of like, must you test God?
Uh huh. Sure. Yeah, he seems to take credit for it. Yeah.
It's kind of subtle in some ways, but like.
Uh huh. It is subtle. What else? Yeah, Felix.
Well, I'm just curious. What does he have a pattern of saying we, or does he usually explicitly refer to God when he does miracles and such in other places?
It's a good question. I'm not familiar with it. I'd have to look it up. Yeah, David.
Yeah, so, I mean, as we've mentioned, Moses has a lot of reason to be frustrated at this point. He seems to be taking his frustration out on the people, and now
right.
He talks to them.
Yeah.
He sounds sort of angry, almost.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
He reverts back to what worked last time.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, how did the water come out last time? He struck it. And that's what he does again this time. Anything else?
I mean, it just seems like he's taking matters into his own hands, like he did before.
Mm-hmm. He's taking matters into his own hands, yeah. Yeah, so Moses does some things, and there's several things that we've noticed that don't seem quite right. But what's the result?
Water.
Water, right? I mean, at the end of the day, everybody's drinking, right? People drank, the livestock drank, everything seemed to be fine. So on the surface, the decision, this process that Moses went to seems to be fine. On the surface, the problem that Moses faced was solved. But we know that the surface isn't all that matters, and that God sees what's happening below the surface. God sees our hearts. God sees what we're thinking and feeling and believing. And that's part of what is the process of growing in walking with God, growing in our ability to make decisions, is realizing that our tendency is so much to be drawn towards the externals. Our tendency so much is to be drawn toward what works. We live in a practical society, in a pragmatic society. We're told if it works, then great. And for a lot of our lives, that's fine, right? I mean, if your car breaks down and you take it somewhere and they fix it and it works, you don't care how they fixed it. All you care about is that you can drive now. And that works for that, unless they like use duct tape and a mile later, it's broken down again. But in general, if it works, then it's good. But when we're thinking about decisions and we're thinking about how we align ourselves with God and what we do and how we treat people, it's not just about the externals. It's not just about how things turn about. There's something else going on. And I'm actually of the opinion that what's more important to God is what's happening inside. That God is less focused on the externals, on the results. That God is less focused about which job you take or which path you choose or which decision you make. And he's more interested in what's happening underneath. He's more interested in your character, in your relationship with him, in your relationship with other people. And so I actually think the process of making decisions is often much more significant than the decision that gets made. But that's very different than the world we live in. The world we live in thinks about externals. One of the tricks, too, is that what I've found is that as I've gotten older, there's less and less external feedback that helps me know, did I make a good decision? Is this a bad decision? So, you know, school is great, right? I mean, you take a quiz and like a day later, you know, you did this well. And there's this scale and you can put yourself on it and you can feel good about yourself if you're here and bad about yourself if you're there. But at least you know how you're doing. And what happens is, and this is, I think, one of the trickiest transitions from college to being post-college, this transitional stage that a lot of you guys are in. What's hard about that is you lose all these external feedback. And the feedback you do get is much more binary, right? It's like, how do you know you're doing a good job? Well, you think you're good, and how do you know you're doing a bad job? You're fired. Like, there's like zero or one, and it's very hard to know. There's no like C+, B-, you know? Or like, how do you know if this relationship is working? It's working. How do you know if it's not? She dumped me. Like, you know, it's very hard to get this graded kind of understanding of feedback to know how to do things. And that's that just continues. It continues to be the case. I often think about this with my children. Like, I'm making so many decisions right now, and I'll find out how I did 20 years from now, you know, when they're actually able to articulate, like, that was good, Daddy, but that was really not. And I was like, why couldn't you tell me now? But you can't. So all of these things, like, you have less and less external feedback coming into you. And so then as we make decisions, it's even more important that we are guided by something internal, that we are guided by God, that we have some sense of what God is doing within us and in our character and our lives, because we can't tell as much how things are going to turn out. So Moses does this, and this is what happens. Read the last couple verses of this passage. This is Numbers 20, 12 to 13. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I will give them. These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord and where he showed himself holy among them. This is crazy, right? Moses led God's people out of Egypt. He did these 10 plagues. He split the Red Sea. He guided God's people. He led them for 40 years. He gets to this place, and in this moment, he does something, and the consequence to that decision is that, forget it, you're not going to bring my people across the border. That's a huge disappointment. All of Moses' life has been moving towards arriving in the promised land. That's what he's been doing. And here, he does something. We're going to talk a little about what that is. But he makes a decision that means he's lost that chance. It's gone. There's no arguing with God. There's no, hey, come on, give me a second chance. God says, because of this moment, you're not going to take my people into the promised land. Now, this is what I'm talking about. Little decisions. Little moments that have huge consequences. For Moses, there was something that happened here that meant what he understood the whole purpose of his life to be was now different. Now, that doesn't mean he had no purpose, because God certainly used him, but God took something away from him that was dear to him. And the question that it forces us to ask is, what did he do? Right? I mean, we noticed all these things. So he struck the rock instead of speaking to it. He was grumpy with the Israelites, right? He seemed to take credit for it. But on the surface, you know, a lot of the guys in the Bible do some really bad things, right? Being grumpy, it seems like maybe you could forgive that. Or, you know, you said speak and I struck. Come on, close enough. Like, it's a little hard to look at the facts and say what he did deserves this type of punishment, this type of consequence. And yet, that's what happens. And so sometimes people try and, you know, figure out, well, what exactly was it? What really was at the heart of what Moses did wrong? Maybe it was this thing that he seemed to take credit. And maybe he didn't give God credit, and maybe that was the really big deal. Or maybe it was that he struck the rock instead of spoke to it. And so he was reverting back to earlier patterns and he wasn't trusting God in the moment. Or maybe it was that he yelled at the Israelites and he said, you know, miserable rebels, why do we have to do this again? Maybe it was because he didn't treat them as God's people. So there's all sorts of things you could zero in on and say, this is why the consequence is so severe. But what's interesting is that the narrator doesn't help. The narrator doesn't tell us exactly what Moses did, which part of his actions led to the consequence. All we know is that what he did issued from lack of faith. Right? Verse 12, because you did not trust in me enough. So God tells Moses that the problem was an internal problem. And I think that it's really intentional that the narrator of this story doesn't say, he didn't trust, the narrator doesn't add a verse and say, Moses' lack of faith was exhibited by his striking instead of speaking, in parentheses, right? I think the narrator wants us to realize this is an internal thing, and if I were to spell out to you exactly what happened externally, then you would go, oh good, if God ever tells me to speak, I'll speak instead of striking the rock. I'm fine. We want to be kept on the level of the internal. We want to stay there and say what was really happening was that Moses lost faith in God. And how that played out, maybe it was one of these things, maybe it was all of these things, maybe it was none of them. Maybe it was simply what was going on inside, and maybe Moses could have said the same things and done the same things with a different heart attitude, and God would have been so upset with him. We don't know exactly for sure. What we do know is that the core issue is that Moses lost faith. There's other situations in the Bible that are similar. Early on in the Bible, Cain offers a sacrifice, and God says, it's not good enough. And we don't know why. We don't have any reason. And again, people come up with theories about, well, it was this, it was that. But ultimately, we don't know. The issue, though, is always about faith. The issue is always about what's going on inside, this internal relationship with God. And what happens to us is that we want guidelines. We want external things. We want to know that we can't ever strike the rock if God tells us to speak to it. And as long as I, you know, stay clear of that one, I'll be fine. We want these external things, and God says, I'm not going to give you them. What I want from you is faith. What I want from you is a heart attitude. And that's really hard to measure. Now, that will play itself out in externals. That will play itself out in how you act, how you treat people, how you make decisions. But those are the symptoms of it. What God's after is this faith. And faith is essentially a relational thing. It's learning to walk with God, learning to trust in God enough to make decisions, walking by him side by side. One of the interesting contrasts that's made in the New Testament, not explicitly, but if you look at how the New Testament speaks of Moses and how the New Testament speaks of Abraham, you notice a big difference. Moses received the law, and Moses set up a pattern that eventually Jesus was going to come and fulfill. But when Moses is spoken of in the New Testament, it's often negatively. So he's always associated with the law. The Pharisees, when Jesus interacts with them, always connect themselves with Moses. They always say, well, we're disciples of Moses. We follow Moses, in contrast to following Jesus. Paul, when he's talking in Romans, links Moses to the law. In Hebrews, he's praised, but he's also mentioned that he had to wear this veil, not to protect people, but to hide the fact that this glory was failing. So Moses actually gets a little bit of a bad rap in the New Testament. In contrast, Abraham is praised. And what's interesting is that Abraham is called the man of faith. Abraham is given this designation as the man that walked in faith. So one of the things we can learn from that, oh, and one really curious thing about Abraham is this verse. Genesis 26:5. God says this. He's repeating the promise to Isaac, Abraham's son, and he says this about Abraham. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws. Did anything strike you as curious about that? Yeah.
What commands, what laws, etc.?
Exactly. God hadn't given any commands or laws or decrees yet, right? So how could Abraham have obeyed them? The law hadn't been given to God's people yet. Abraham was centuries earlier. So there's this really interesting thing that Abraham is called the man of faith, and yet he's also said that he fulfilled the law perfectly. Moses was given the law. He was given all of these external things that we think we want. And yet, what was the result? He lost faith. So there's this interesting dynamic going on between law and faith. So could it be that Moses, by having all of these laws, by having all of these external regulations, that actually impeded his faith? And that Abraham, because he had this relationship with God of faith, of trust, because he was focused on that, he ended up fulfilling the externals even centuries before they were given. See, the heart thing is what Abraham had. The heart thing is faith. The law was given to help people into that, but as Paul says in Romans, the law ends up leading to more sin often rather than leading to faith. And so as we're facing decisions, as we're facing moments, the key thing is just to do it with God, to be there with him, to invite him into it. And it doesn't make it easier, per se, but it's the same thing where, you know, you're going through something tough, you have a crisis, you lose your job, something bad happens, a relative gets sick or something, and you want somebody to be with you. It doesn't make it better. It doesn't fix the problem, but the presence of somebody is significant in that moment. And that's what we're looking at here, is this presence of God, faith in him, walking through decisions. We still have to make tough decisions. There's still things we get to where there's two forks in the road and we don't know which one, and we're going to have to decide and you know, debate and struggle with that. But God is in there with us, and we're inviting him in there. As I said, my daughter and I went to Disneyland last Friday. And I think the most, I suppose it's because of what we've been talking about here, but I was struck by how many decisions you have to make. Not just at Disneyland, but just wherever you go. So we left Thursday and we get on a plane and we fly and we get to the airport and we take a shuttle and we get to the hotel and we go for a walk and find a restaurant, and then should we walk back? Should we do this? And there's all these little kind of completely insignificant decisions that we make, right? Where to eat? Are you done? Not yet. Do you want some water? Do you want juice? Can I, you know, all of these little things. But I found myself, and we even talked about it together, my daughter and I, and we realized that part of the best thing of that experience was just doing that together. Just walking along each side each other and saying, hey, I'm thirsty. Hey, me too. Let's stop and get a drink, you know? And just that little kind of insignificant stuff, but you're making decisions together, and you're walking through life and you're approaching stuff. And that's kind of the picture, I think, of what I want to encourage us to do with God, to invite him into those things. And I think that's at heart what Moses lost. And like I said, maybe it resulted in being grumpy or striking or taking credit or whatever, maybe all of those. But what happened at heart was that he lost this faith, this heart with God. Now, Moses ends up dying on the far side of the Jordan, and he doesn't go to the Promised Land. He's buried, and the people go in. But as I said, Moses becomes the precursor. He becomes the model from which Jesus comes. And Jesus comes in a lot of ways as a second Moses. And he brings people out of slavery. And what does Jesus do? What does he teach us? What does he give us? Faith. Jesus teaches us what Moses failed in. He teaches us how to have faith in God. Hebrews says he's the author and perfecter of our faith. And when we believe in him, when we trust him, then we do this. We walk with God. And that's kind of the whole goal.